NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, Todd. You've got some interesting things to talk about today, so why don't we start it off?
Indeed. Those of you watching the video version of this podcast will see the name Rohan Guskin, who is going to be our guest today. Let's just describe what Rohan's been doing. Rohan's working on his private pilot, and he is flying all over Northern California. He's from the Bay Area, like myself. He's even flown off the coast of Catalina Island, something that I'm afraid to do, flying over a big piece of water like that in a single-engine airplane. So he's doing that, and he's also engaged in policy-related work, looking at airspace use for VFR versus IFR aircraft in the Bay Area. And he told us before the show that he's going to be going over and speaking to the California Pilots Association about these issues. And he's looking at 10 different airports in California, mostly Northern California now, but expanding to other areas, where he's going to be figuring out things that could help all the GA community. And you would think somebody like this is like 40 years old, but how old did he say he was, John?
16, if.
16. Too young for a pilot's license. He has to wait till age 17. And he's doing stuff that most 40-year-olds who've been in aviation haven't been doing. And to top it off, he wants to be a mechanical aerospace engineer, and he's looking at several colleges. He'll be graduating next year. So, when I told John, hey, this guy would be very interesting for our audience, what do you think so far from our pre-show interview we had with him?
Oh, this kid's got a lot going for himself. I'd like to trade places with him. I'd like to be that young again and taking on the world the way he is.
There are many people in the audience and both of us here hosting the show who feel the way you do. Maybe not 16. I'll even take 46 at this point. But no more old guy jokes.
If you're going to go for it, go for the guts on me. Take all you can get.
Oh, my goodness. So across the country, what are the issues you've seen over the years being with the NTSB and being in aviation in general when it comes to that sort of thing? Because when you're talking about VFR versus IFR, or, especially congested airspace, class Bravo and airspace especially like we have here in the Bay Area, what have been the ongoing issues from a safety perspective of that sort of, potential conflict?
Well, all those conflicts, the rules might say you could fly VFR on a given day in a given area, but with today's traffic and so many airplanes on routinely taking instrument flights, just as the added safety piece that it gives, you have natural conflicts there. I think that in the areas where we're really crowded in the airspace, I think we should really restrict it to all instrument flying. When I think about the Cerritos accident in Los Angeles many years ago, with a general aviation airplane flying into the approach path of an IFR airplane on approach to LAX. I mean, yeah, people make mistakes. You get into airspace that you shouldn't get into. But when you're in GA airspace and you're not paying attention as you should, and we see a lot of people today that aren't paying attention to the level that they're required to. I mean, if you make everybody fly instrument rules, it does help a lot.
And going back in history a bit, the Cerritos event was in 1986, which is well before ADS-B. And this was a situation where certainly the private aircraft, and I can't remember the accident report, might have had a transponder on board. But remind me, when was that TCAS essentially universally applied for commercial airliners?
I forget what the it was in process right then. No. I can remember working, installing the systems on airplanes. So I worked for US Air then, and we had TCAS installation line within our hangar. So we were bringing airplanes in every day to sequentially start the process of putting TCAS on the airplanes.
And then, as now, there's another twist to this. The aircraft that were involved, there was a private, I think it was a Piper Archer, low-wing, a single-engine airplane, and a DC-9 from Aeromexico. And there you get into a situation of they're not flying Part 121. Today they'd be flying Part 129, I believe it is. And the requirements for Part 129 are somewhat different from 121. And depending on what the equipment's being required, maybe they will have to have it at the same time as Part 121. Maybe there might be an exception for overseas airlines coming in. So even if you have a safety system in place being implemented across, let's say, the U.S. fleet, doesn't necessarily mean the overseas fleets from the various countries will get it done at the same time. Am I off base on any part of that?
No. Because availability of the hardware oftentimes limits how fast you can get it implemented. You know, TCAS is not a simple system to put on the airplane, and getting the black boxes to install on the airplane can be a challenge to have them manufactured at the speed that we could upgrade the airplanes at. So there's always a year or two implementation, sometimes more.
So with that, this is a perfect intro to our special guest today, Rohan Guskin. Am I pronouncing your last name correct?
You are, yes, sir.
Very good. Pleasure to have you here. We've already talked about your accomplishments by the age of 16, which I'm sure has impressed most of our audience by now. And what you were talking about, or what you've been studying, airspace use, especially VFR versus IFR, reminded us of a 86 mid-air collision down in Southern California over Cerritos involving a small single-engine GA aircraft and a DC-9. And the subject was, well, if you had equipment, let's say like TCAS, would it be implemented as quickly with an overseas airline operating under Part 129 versus a domestic one operating under 121? But before we get into the details of your research about airspace use, is that accident one that's come up in your research?
It's not one I've looked into too extensively, but it is those kind of conflicts that I'm looking at, interactions between VFR aircraft and IFR aircraft in these complex airspace environments, like in Los Angeles and San Francisco regions, and it's so those sort of conflicts that are showing up just because of the way our airspace system is set up. It's we have areas where VFR aircraft are coming through airliner paths, I'm pretty sure that's the conflict that was happening in that event. And then it relies upon the air traffic controller and TCAS to deconflict those aircraft, rather than having, for example, Bravo airspace that protects those paths. So the Bravo would protect the aircraft paths to a point, but then eventually they're all just going to be in the echo or whatever it may be. And you get those kind of conflicts.
Now, I am remiss in my duties here. Like every good superhero movie franchise, the first episode is the origin story. So we got to get some origin story here. You are flying out of the east side of San Francisco Bay. Hayward Airport is your home airport?
Yeah.
Hayward Airport, for those of you who are geography fans, you know that that is very close to or adjacent to the Class Bravo airspace out of San Francisco. Plus, you have Oakland Airport even closer to you, not to mention San Jose Airport down the road. And you learn how to fly in this flying environment?
Yeah, it's a challenging and very fun environment, navigating this airspace. We have a lot of, flight following is a prerequisite for flights in this area as pilots around here, know. And yeah, it's a very fun environment to learn in. And I got a lot of the experiences, both this complex environment, like we have, in addition, Oakland's Class Charlie right off the end of Hayward's Delta, so there's no straight out departures. And then we have the Oakland Finals coming right over the pattern for Hayward. So there's a lot of moving parts in this airspace. And then just going a little bit to the east, you have a bunch of uncontrolled fields. And so it's a very diverse environment that it's a very, very nice place to learn to fly.
Now, you say using words like nice and fun. That would not be the choices I'd use. I learned how to fly like 30 miles north of Austin. Let's just say we had a lot less traffic than you have around here. And I think we were not even class Delta. I think we were like uncontrolled airspace back then. This was like, oh, gosh, 78, I first started flying. But let's talk about you and not me. You started flying at age what, 15?
14.
Oh, my gosh. How old were you when you said to yourself, I want to fly?
I think I was about 9 years old. I got my first flight simulator, X-Plane 11, little plastic yoke, and I would play on my laptop, and it constantly froze. But I was having the time of my life, so I kept on flying through there. I got experience doing like online flying, so I was talking to virtual air traffic control. I just loved it so much. I wanted to start as soon as I could. There's no age limit to start flying, but my parents didn't think it was a good idea for like a 10-year-old to start flying in this area. And I think that was the right decision. So I waited. So I started at 14, started flying around out of Hayward, and then about a year into flying, I got a apprenticeship at a local aviation maintenance shop. So I went there after school as much as I could, and I learned a lot through there in terms of the maintenance side and the system side. That was also helpful for learning how to fly and moving towards my license.
You just said the magic M word, maintenance. And with that, John, I'm sure you have some questions for Rohan about his maintenance program.
I'm just sitting here smiling because your path is very similar to mine, because I hung around the airports when I was 14 years old and maybe even a little earlier, maybe even late 13. And I flew constantly with everybody that I could. And back then, just outside of Boston, it was all just wide open spaces. So I flew and flew and flew. I flew washing airplanes and hanging around the hangar. And eventually, when I was 14, I started flying for real. And I never told my parents in the beginning that I was flying with all these guys. They thought I was hanging around the airport, and I was making a little bit of money cleaning airplanes. Those that I didn't fly on, but others I cleaned to go fly with them. And by 15, I had already soloed. It was the hangar, the airports, the 14 years old, very similar.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I had the privilege of not having to wash planes. Like I know a lot of people go that path or having to fund their own flight journey. So I was privileged to be able to go and try to learn as much as possible, and go and get experiences all across the area down to, Catalina. That was a great flight, and I didn't have to pay for anything but fuel. So.
By the way, we had a discussion about your Catalina experience at the Aviation 2026 conference, AIAA conference in San Diego, where we met face-to-face for the first time. And I think I said something to you to the effect of, flying to Catalina, that means you're flying over a big piece of water. I've never done something like that. You would consider it fun. I consider it a nerve-wracking experience.
Yeah, I think it's both. Obviously, want to be as safe as possible, wear your life jackets. We flew, we had as little time or as long as possible within gliding distance. And so I don't want to give people advice on how to fly into Catalina. But
here's a piece of advice I think you can give us right now. Talk to us about your pre-flight planning experience.
I'm just going to go.
That's one of our ongoing subjects on this podcast, pre-flight.
Yeah. So that was a long process. I went back and forth with the owner of the aircraft, and we both bounced plans off each other. We briefed everything. I'm not sure how far it was, but we made sure that we knew it was happening at every stage of the flight. So obviously we run into some unexpected things, like we were losing radio coverage, over a portion of the route. And so it was hard to get in contact with air traffic control, but when you have the thorough plan made and you've done a thorough pre-flight, those kind of things are easier to manage.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.
Were you flying solo or flying with the owner or flying with someone else?
I was left seat, the owner was right seat, and my instructor was in the back seat.
So was the instructor barking orders, or was the instructor quite satisfied with the dynamics of yourself and the other pilot?
He was satisfied. It was useful. The pilot next to me, the owner of the aircraft, had a lot of experience. This was his first time going to Catalina, though. So we were both having that first experience. But in the back seat, my instructor sort of he provided another, like if we were making a decision up front, then he was like, oh, well, maybe you should consider this. And provided another, two more eyes, out the window for seeing and avoiding traffic. So that was very helpful.
So where did you depart from the last point before going to Catalina?
We flew Hayward, stopped for fuel at Santa Barbara, and went to Catalina, yeah.
Looking at the visual on the screen, for those of you watching the video version of this, we're showing the route of flight. So Hayward, Santa Barbara, what was the next leg? Where did you fly over?
And then it was
LAX directly, or?
Yeah, we flew through through the Bravo at LAX. I can't remember what transition route we used, but it was not the the special flight. It was Area's slightly higher route.
Now, it doesn't show on the graphic I had up earlier. At the time you were flying, were there any restrictions because of Vandenberg launches, which SpaceX seems to be doing one every week down there?
There was not at the time. I believe we just missed it. But yeah, we were able to send it down there pretty direct. It was not in a very fast aircraft, so it was about an 8-hour round trip. And when we got to Catalina, they had closed the restaurant, sadly. So it was just a cookie. No full meal.
No $100 hamburger.
No $100 hamburger.
So what did you think of the airport at Catalina? Was it particularly difficult to land and take off? Were there like obstacles and such?
The one thing I would note was, the incline. I'm not sure what the incline is, but there was an incline, taking off. And I rotated slightly early, because of that incline. So I would just say that's something to look for, when you're there.
Was it upward incline or downward incline when you took off?
Upward incline.
So Todd's trying to pick your brain here because he's thinking he's going to try to do this himself.
Only on a flight simulator. By the way, did you use your flight simulator to scope this out before you flew?
Not right before I flew, but I had flown into Catalina before, in the flight simulator. So, but that is a useful tool for, if you don't have, experience going into there yet.
Okay.
I have a friend of mine in North Carolina who had a portable, flight simulator, like Flight, X, in a trailer, a tow around trailer, and he would take it to different airports around his area and show students before they were going off on their cross country. They would go from North Carolina to Virginia, and he had the Virginia airports loaded on there so that they could practice landing and wherever they were going. But it is a useful tool to do that before you fly in because it gets rid of a lot of anxiety and when you're flying in and you recognize the landmarks, you recognize what's going on. It helps a lot.
Now, yeah, let's definitely talk about another Southern California experience you had, not involving an airplane, going to Aviation 2026, AIAA meeting, which had a wide range of presenters and whatnot, and you graciously accepted my invitation to come watch me do my presentation, which will be the subject of another podcast we're doing, so we're not going to talk about that. But I want to talk to you about your experience around these aviation professions.
Yeah, it was a great experience hearing from – we had industry and research sides there, so I was able to attend some more research-focused presentations, a lot of advanced air mobility focus right now on the research side and how we can incorporate that into our airspace. That was sort of the overarching theme going throughout the conference, AAM and sustainability. And I also heard from the industry members and industry leaders and government leaders. I found that the focus was on innovation with safety And how do we balance pushing aviation forward while making sure, for example, with autonomous aircraft and eVTOLs, what are the kind of certification standards, and how do we innovate while maintaining safe airspace?
What was the most eye-opening thing you saw at the conference?
Well, I wouldn't say it's one thing, but more of the environment and the consistency between the work that's going on, in that it seems like the community is very close together, and is looking for the best ways to push the new technologies forward, rather than a bunch of isolated things going on.
So let me ask you two questions specific about the conference itself. What would you recommend that AIAA do to attract people from your demographic? Young, coming up through the system, late high school, early college. What should they do, if anything, to encourage them to come down there and hang out? Lower prices, more prizes, whatever.
Well, there wasn't really a very much outreach to the high school demographic. There was a lot of a lot of AIAA college programs and things like that, but I haven't seen. Maybe there is, and I haven't seen them. But I personally didn't find it through any sort of official program. Just more my own research. So I think if it's a priority for AIAA to incorporate more young people into their environment, I think outreach directly to my kind of demographic would be the way to do that.
Now, I mentioned prizes for a reason, because many conferences, the exhibitors, have giveaways for people, and some are going to be more attractive to younger students than others. So if you were to tell the exhibitor floor, people on the exhibitor floor, unfortunately, I couldn't stay for that part of it, what things should they give away as incentives to encourage younger people to show up on the exhibitor floor?
It's not the type of environment catered to people in high school. That's not the focus, but more maybe just opportunities beyond specific, like, I'm in industry, you're in industry, like collaborations like that, but maybe more programs for young people, I guess I would say. I'm not sure exactly. I mean, for me personally, I like being in those types of environments where maybe it's not necessarily catered to me, but it's more of a professional environment. That's kind of where I thrive.
One professional question I forgot to follow up on. You're in a high school maintenance program. Is this a program that will end up with either a power plant or airframe certificate?
So it's less a program and just more. I'm not currently doing that work. I was doing it for a while. I got quite busy with some other things, but it's something I definitely want to get back into. I'm not sure of any specific programs high schools can go into for a path to that, but that is what I was on my way to. And I say to anybody doing that, make sure to log your hours, because it was like halfway through doing that, and they're like, how many hours do you have? I don't know how many hours I have. So it's not just for pilots. It's for mechanics too.
Very true. Very true. And there are a number of high schools around the country. In fact, at our skills competition, both Todd and I are involved with the aerospace maintenance skills competition called The Competition. And once a year, we bring 500 mechanics in, and some of which want to be mechanics, and they compete for a whole bunch of Snap-on tools. But the more important point is that we've had a number of high schools, aviation high school in New York. There's also an aviation high school in Dayton, Ohio, who this past year we had a competition at the Verticon, which is the Helicopter Association trade show. And we had Army teams there, helicopter teams. We had commercial teams. And the overall was won by the high school. So it was I loved it. I loved it when that happened. It's encouraging with some of the young folks and what they're bringing to the table today.
Absolutely.
So a message to the industry, don't rest on your laurels. The upcoming generation is on your tail. So one more marketing note. You're going to apply to college next year. You told us before, actually, I think earlier in the show, that you wanted to be an aerospace engineer. So all of you aerospace engineering programs out there, if anyone's involved in one of these, you see the product here, or the potential student here, rather. Reach out to us, and we can reach out to him. Also, marketing message for you. The link to the show, whenever you have an application to whatever school, mention this link somewhere. It's like, look, don't take my word for it. Look at me in my natural environment being peppered with hardcore questions and how I responded. This is proof to you that I deserve to be in your program.
How true.
You think we're kidding?
Absolutely.
No, we're not. As you told me,
I know.
The competition is tough. You don't want to go to just any place. You want to go to a very good place. Now, you did mention a school that's near where I live, Stanford. You didn't mention a school I'm more associated with, MIT. Okay, I'll get over that disappointment. But hey, East Coast, West Coast.
No, it's there. I didn't mention it, but it's.
You didn't mention it, Emory Riddle either.
You're putting me in a corner here.
Yes,
well,
indeed.
There's a lot of good schools. North Dakota, the University of Illinois, and in Urbana. There's a lot of good schools out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think we're at the point now where we do the traditional thing that we do, the second to last word. And my second to last word would be very brief. We should have people like you on more often. That's my second to last word.
Yeah, this was a fun podcast. This was a fun one. So I'm glad. But as always, I have to just lay it out there. And if you're going to go flying, you need to do a good job of pre-planning. And if you stay to the end here, you heard a good example of pre-planning for a very could have been a very challenging flight. So you need to do a good job of pre-planning. Do it at home before you go to the airport. Do it again at the airport. Make sure they agree. Do a good pre-flight on your airplane. We still see pre-flights that leave a lot to be desired. And when you get in the air, and you also heard Ryan mention that, with an extra pair of eyes in his airplane going to Catalina, having that extra pair of eyes, making sure that their pathway was clear, see and avoid is still a major piece of our mid-air collision problems. And with that, I'll say, please fly safely.
Let me talk to the folks who have joined the Flight Safety Detectives, our members. We thank you very much for doing so. And we're hoping that you are enjoying your membership and the benefits that come with that, including getting early access to new episodes and other goodies to be determined later. And if you're interested in becoming a member, you'll see a graphic on the screen with an arrow pointing to the join button on the YouTube channel. Join, do what is necessary to become a member at whatever level you'd like, and enjoy those benefits. And if you have questions, whether or not you're a member or not, write to us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And we're not leaving out sponsors. We love sponsors. We can always use more, and we hope that you can use our content to attract our audience to your product or service. Contact us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We'll have a conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you, so we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing Program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.